From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. I'd like you to take a moment to listen along with me to how George the Poet starts the very first episode of his podcast.
My name's George the Poet, but right now I'm Uncle George, watching my nephews play with their friends. I'm 20 years older than these kids, and I'm imagining what the next 20 years will be like for them. Some of them will obviously be dead. Some in jail. Some sitting right here watching their own kids, asking the same questions. People get uncomfortable when you talk about children like that. Like there's a cause and effect relationship between the things we say aloud and the way the future pans out. Like these negative prospects are less likely for our children if we don't acknowledge the current reality. Maybe words really are that powerful. Or maybe that's just a story we tell ourselves to imagine power into existence.
That's from the very first episode of the Peabody Award-winning Have You Heard George's Podcast. And George Mpenga, a.k.a. George the Poet, joins us now from London. Welcome to On Point, George.
Thank you so much, Meghna. Thank you so much.
You know, usually I would spend some time in the scripting to this show to formally introduce a guest, you know, describing your work, who you are, where you grew up, the awards that you've won. But I didn't actually do that this time for a couple of reasons. And the first of them is that I don't really know how to describe your podcast. Genre bending is the phrase I keep coming back to. But so I just thought it was better to ask you about the podcast. How would you describe what Have You Heard George's Podcast is?
I would say it's a multi-dimensional diary. I could call it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could describe it as a musical diary or maybe an interactive to an extent. But what is consistent across the podcast experience for me is my personal, my innermost perspective and just a refusal to land on one dimension of storytelling.
Mm. Well, there's no doubt that when I listen and you start hearing the podcast, you are immediately taken into multiple different dimensions, George. I mean, it's a remarkable piece of work and it's being duly recognized as such. So I will say that just last week, your podcast was the first European podcast to ever win a Peabody Award. 7 awards at the 2019 British Podcast Award, including Podcast of the Year. It won Best Podcast at the NME Awards. Not bad.
Yeah, very, very much a thumbs up. You know, what makes it even sweeter for me is that I gave myself the most difficult brief because I didn't want to leave any of my more innovative ideas on the table. But all of those ideas are intimidating for me to try and introduce to an audience that didn't request any of this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice to be vindicated.
Yeah. Well, I want to come back in a minute to what some of those ideas are. But I just also wanted to share with you the second reason why I didn't start off with, you know, this is On Point and George the Poet is blah, 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 blah. It's because of what we played in that clip, that very first moment from the first episode of the podcast. Because you talk about the stories that people tell themselves to imagine power into existence. And you also talk about the stories that outsiders tell about communities and like rewriting and reimagining those stories for yourself. So I'm hoping you might be able to tell your story. I don't want to tell it at all. So can you just tell like the beginning of George Mpenga's story? Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Northwest London on a housing estate called St. Raphael's Estate, close to Wembley. A lot of people know Wembley Arena, or Wembley Stadium. That was near to me, but where we lived was like a different economic reality. It wasn't the worst on a global scale, but it had higher than average rates of unemployment, crime, black people. And I eventually moved on. The first time I transitioned out of that environment was when I entered, we call it secondary school over here. So I was 11 years old, transitioning into another level of school. And my parents sent me out of the area. And that was the beginning of a very interesting journey.
Mm. Why did they make that choice for you?
My big brother had been in a local school, and it presented challenges that my parents hadn't anticipated. My parents didn't grow up in the UK, you see. They grew up in Uganda, and they came here when they were just a bit younger than me, and started a family. So there was a level of readjustment that they had to do culturally, first of all to British society, then to Black British society. My brother went to a local school with a lot of local kids. And like I said, they were met with challenges that cast their attention outside of our area when it came to my school.
What were those challenges?
Very low expectations on the part of the educational establishment. My brother is a smart guy, was always a smart kid. Like a lot of young black males in particular throughout our education system, he was an overachiever at points in his early school career. But when he got to secondary school, it's like not only was he exposed to pressures, insecurities, dangers that my parents were not aware of. The school just didn't expect much of him. Mm-hmm. So when his school career was kind of, you know, experiencing challenges, they weren't even feeding back to my mom that there were any problems. It was only through my parents' diligence that they were aware of the need for change. Mm.
And so you're their second born child, right?
That's right.
And they tried to bring that change into your life. And so what was it like going to that secondary school outside of your community?
It was inspirational in many respects. It was in a very affluent area. I had to travel an hour and a half every morning and every afternoon to get there and come back. But at the same time, it was a culture clash. They had a particular ideology of what a successful young man should be. They had a particular ideology of how you can make your best contribution to society. And on reflection, I didn't feel like I was presenting any of my ideas or my experience to the school system. I felt like I was there to be taught who I should be.
I mean, I guess one could argue that that is one of the primary functions of the sort of socializing functions of public of educate
right.
of education. But what was the kind of person that they were trying to shape you into being that didn't quite fit who you are?
Well, there are clues of who they wanted us to be in the rules and the regulations and the informal practices that were just part and parcel of the experience. So the way they policed our language, our dress, our haircuts, our behavior in subtle ways that can't really be, it would be hard to convey. It would be hard to convey like the impact of a comment a teacher might make in the way that you are engaging with your peers that might belittle you, you know, but that happened. And it was a great school. That comes first. In my assessment, that comes first. The teaching was great. The system was dedicated and their formula was tried and tested. But for me, it never fit. And for a lot of the boys, it was a boys' school. For a lot of the boys, it didn't. But many of them came from Indian communities that had a particular strategy of social mobility, which required them to basically assimilate with the ideology that the school was presenting. But for some of us Black kids, that just wasn't, it wasn't that straightforward.
So let me ask you, you said a couple of minutes ago, we've got about a minute and a half, George, before we have to take our first break here, that that your parents immigrating to the UK from Uganda, they had to go through two major moments of their own education, right? Learning about British society and then learning about Black British society. Can you tell me more about that second one?
Black Britain is it's an experience throughout British society that is really, Black Britain, first of all, is a mashup of a lot of different communities from all over the world, mainly Africa and the Caribbean. And the Black British experience, it can't be explained in 30 seconds. So I'm not gonna try yet.
Well, what I'll do is I will take a quick break here and maybe give you a little bit more time on the other side of the break to try
Perfect.
To try and explain it. And also we should say, not that it's an explanation, but this is one of the dimensions in your multi-dimensional podcast that I think listeners' minds are opened to when they listen to the podcast. So we are talking this hour with George Mpanga. He is also known as George the Poet. He's a London-based spoken word artist and the voice behind the multi-award-winning Have You Heard George's podcast. And we're talking to him about history, about culture, about racism, about colonialism. There's a lot more to cover when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with George Mpanga, a.k.a. George the Poet. He's the London-based spoken word artist, which doesn't begin to describe the work that he does in his award-winning podcast. Have You Heard George's podcast is the first European podcast ever to win a Peabody Award. It swept British-based podcast awards in 2019 as well. And so let's listen to a little bit of why this is so special. This is episode 13 of Have You Heard George's podcast. And George the Poet asks listeners to follow them into the corridor of his mind, at which point he starts opening doors that lead into his past.
Picture my face. Start zooming in to those eight balls inside the cue balls, aka my pupils. You're entering the window to my soul. It's like a black hole, a gateway to another universe, which you can only discover through the verse. So now that you're here, do me a favor, close your eyes. Imagine a long corridor with scriptures on the floor and pictures on the walls and different colored doors that represent my visions and my thoughts. Yeah.
A moment from Have You Heard George's podcast by George the Poet? And we should say that he collaborates with producer and composer Ben Brick on the podcast as well. George, before the break, I had asked you to describe Black Britain a little bit. And I want to acknowledge that that's a massive question, and I appreciated that you didn't want to answer it in less than a minute. I'm not even sure it could be answered in the remaining 30 minutes that we have here, but I wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit more about what you meant when you said your parents had to learn about Black Britain.
Well, Black Britain is an experience that is distinct to, as I was explaining earlier, the patchwork, the cultural patchwork of African and Caribbean immigrant societies that exist in the UK. And it's a patchwork because, as I was explaining, my parents' generation and I guess the grandparents of my Caribbean peers, they only got to the country relatively recently. So this is distinct from the African-American experience because people who self-define as African-American have typically been there, or their families, their lineage has been there, dating back to the transatlantic slave trade. So that's like hundreds of years. So the reason that's significant is because African-American consciousness has had hundreds of years to form. Black British consciousness has had some decades. That's not to say that there were no Black people in Britain before the 20th century. It's just that in our numbers, our ability to form a collective that has some sort of collective voice in this country has been a project of the past 60 years. Now, my parents grew up as Ugandans, and that's a different cultural experience. Specifically, they grew up in relative privilege. They had access to education that many didn't, and they ultimately had the means to relocate, which many didn't. However, when you're to be received and assimilated into Black Britain in the 80s, it's like that cultural richness that you're bringing from Uganda is not recognized by British society and is barely recognized by Black British society. So that was an adjustment they had to make.
So where does that put you now then in terms of your experience as a Black Briton? I mean, do you feel that you said it's only, it's a project thus far only of several decades in terms of forming that cultural consciousness, but do you feel that it has gelled or is gelling?
I do. And I think it gels or it eventually makes sense because we exist, because we human beings live these confluences and these tensions. We become the story. So in our growth, in our maturity, in our struggles, we provide or let's say we enrich the history. We make sense of our experience over our lifetimes. So let me give you a tangible example of that. When we were kids, my big brother and I were teased a lot for being African, just literally for being African. And a lot of African kids in my generation can remember that. And the teasing, for those of us who grew up in the Black community, mainly came from the Caribbean kids our age. And the reason for that was there was a resentment in much of Caribbean consciousness, especially my experience of Jamaican consciousness at that time, which transformed later on in my life. I can explain that later. But at the time, Jamaican consciousness had a part of it that was slightly resentful towards Africans or towards what they understood about Africans. Many of the older generation of Jamaicans had it in that, had the association of Africans as traitors who sold them into slavery. And I didn't understand that when I was younger, but what the way we experienced that was contempt. Like a lot of the Jamaicans just had contempt for us. You also need to consider the poor representation of Africa that was commonplace across Western societies. So these African Caribbean guys, yeah, whose ascendants were in the continent of Africa, they look at their African counterparts as at the time they looked at them as inferior. But into my adulthood, that has no longer become a thing among our generation. We've begun to intermarry. We have created musical genres together. We've created slang together. And I've ultimately come to understand that much of the African Caribbean society in this country feels just as displaced as much of the African society does. So therein, we have a common problem. And that gets very interesting.
Yeah. You know, in hearing you describe the, I guess, tensions is a mild way of putting it, between sort of Caribbean and African communities in the neighborhoods that you grew up. Of course, one of the things I kept thinking about was, and the thing that definitely one of the things that brings that's common to all of these children and their families that you're talking about is the fact of the British Empire, right? That they were all subjects of colonialism, and that is, you know, that is the reason why so many of those families ultimately ended up in the UK was through the machinations of empire.
Exactly.
And yet, it does make perfect sense because of the complex relationships that communities have with the idea of what the British Empire was and was supposed to stand for. I mean, I want to acknowledge that. I hear a lot about it in my own family, let me tell you. But the reason why I bring that up is colonialism and racism. And I just want to talk with you about how you engage with those very powerful forces in your podcast. So can you tell me more about that?
Well, it's important to understand, Meghna, that my podcast is an extension of a broader inquiry that has been happening across my adulthood. Mm-hmm. So the minute I started university, I was looking back at my experience growing up, and I was studying sociology. So I was not only had the space to reflect, but I had I was being given the disciplinary tools and frameworks that would allow me to dismantle, you know, some of the structures around my thinking. So with that opportunity came deep reflection, self-discovery, and I was doing poetry. So the expressive element became increasingly important. By the time I left university, I was adamant that it was my responsibility as someone who had the opportunity to study our experience. It was my responsibility to share as much of what I had learned as possible. Plan A was to do that through poetry. That had success. However, I was still swimming against the tide because there was no existing demand for poetry. I suspected there was latent demand, and what I was able to do through my earlier career was tap into that latent demand. So, for example, I did poems for commercial purposes, for adverts and for corporate engagements. And I was given very sophisticated briefs about what specifically they wanted me to talk about using my poetry. And I was happy to do that because I needed that stimulation and I needed a transactional way of making money out of this craft. Mm. But then I transitioned more into the cultural media space and I started making music, pop music, really, under the music industry, under a record deal with Island Records. And we were successful in that. However, I felt there was a growing tension between my social agenda, my obligation to my community, and my presence as an entertainer. I was not comfortable with that tension. Therefore, I stepped back from the music industry. Without a clear idea of what I wanted to do, I realized that there were other storytelling avenues I hadn't pursued yet, namely TV. So in this interim, I've stepped away from the music industry and I threw myself into studying TV. And while I'm studying TV, I've started to notice more storytelling opportunities for myself. I realized I could make a TV series in audio form to offset the risk of trying to make a TV show with a partner who will probably behave just like the music industry behaved towards me. So I didn't want that risk. I wanted to be able to basically sketch out a TV show in which I would interrogate the biggest questions of my life. So that's why I ended up expressing reflections on colonialism in the podcast in the way that I did. Now, I was adamant that these expressions would be as helpful to the listener as possible. In order to make it helpful, I had to take that opportunity to be honest about how I felt with regards to the history of the British Empire, specifically its interaction with Uganda, that had big implications for my parents, for their parents, for their parents. And I wanted to be honest about that. However, I also wanted to offer an olive branch and be able to say, considering the history, this is how I would like to engage with this society moving forward. And the easiest way for me to express that was to personify British society as a woman with whom I had a complicated relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I think we have I'm thinking of a different cut, which we don't quite have. Well, so complicated relationship. I mean, that's the perfect way to describe Britain's own relationship with its history as, at one point in time, the world's dominant colonial power. I mean, earlier this month, you had been on BBC's Newsnight, and you sent out a tweet after that. You said, "My appearance on Newsnight yesterday reminded me that racism convos are weakened by gaps in our information. Ideally, we would all leave school with a basic awareness of Britain's leading role in the oppression of black and brown people, but we're a long way from this." How far away is British society from that?
Well, British society is far away enough that I could go on basically the BBC, the biggest broadcast, and the flagship broadcasting company of this country. And I could talk about the relation of BLM, Black Lives Matter, to Black British society. And I can, in all seriousness, be asked, well, it's not that bad, is it? That question should indicate how far Britain is from an honest conversation.
Wait, you were told that racism in the UK is not that as bad as the United States? Is that what the implication was?
That was the implication. Now, it will take, I think, a long time for societies like mine, rich, predominantly white societies, to understand how inappropriate that kind of comparison is. It's very chauvinistic. It's emotionally abusive. You know, your forebears struck very one-way deals with my forebears, which led to perpetual confusion and disarray economically and politically across the society that my ancestors came from. And you guys seem to be okay. You have a very rich and influential society and a brand that is respected across the world. And we have never had a conversation about what went wrong officially. You've never apologized. But you're going to ask me basically if I am grateful that you're not as bad as your other white counterparts in another part of the world who incidentally came from the same society as you. It's not fair.
I don't even know where to go with that. George, only because can I just share one little story? It's just like a little tiny, my personal data point on this.
Yeah.
So, I mean, look, I'm living here in the United States, and we are not fully reckoned with our own history and realities here. So I'm not saying that it's any better here. But my parents immigrated to the U.S. from India. But in the early 70s, when my mother left India, her first stop for a little while was London. And then she came, like a couple of weeks after that, she came here to Boston in the United States. And she told me later on, she said, "London was so racist in just the few weeks that she was there that it made Boston, Massachusetts in the 1970s feel like a paradise. So,
wow.
So, and Boston in the 70s was definitely not a paradise. But anyway,
wow.
So that reckoning, I completely hear you. And I want to talk more about that when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we are going to be talking about police use of tear gas on protesters in the United States. Soldiers in the battlefield are not allowed to use tear gas, so why is it being used on American streets? So we want to hear from you. How do you feel about the use of tear gas against protesters? If you were out on the streets and were tear gassed yourself, tell us your story. What was that like? If you're a law enforcement officer in cities and states that are trying to ban tear gas, what do you think about that? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That is for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking with George Mpenga, a.k.a. George the Poet. He is a multi-award-winning spoken word artist who won the first ever Peabody Award for a European broadcast for his podcast, Have You Heard George's Podcast. And by the way, the music you've been hearing this hour is music from the podcast, which George makes in collaboration with producer and composer Ben Brick. Now, George, if I could, I want to play a moment from the podcast where you talk about something that happened to you in 2018. You were outside your parents' house. You had just finished a sold-out show. And as you were outside your parents' house, you were approached by police, handcuffed, and searched. And here's how you talk about that in episode 4 of your podcast.
After that night, I just wanted to be left alone, so I went to my second home, Uganda. I wanted to be around some true survivors, speaking to Uber drivers, conversations getting deeper than scuba divers, conscious of the absence of the people that grew beside us. I put my earphones in place, turn up the track till I'm hearing a bass, and steer into space.
Destined for top spots, investments and much more. Brew where they earth, man. Bang, bang, it's guy food. A place that's so frightening, Colombian drug food. Just hungry, it's awful, so crack to their own food.
I'm in the Uber listening to Mucky. This one's called It's On Me, and I feel this strongly. I gaze into the distance, thinking about black people's engagement with the systems of criminal justice and formal education. Both of them are used as a form of segregation.
I want 8 million, rest in peace, 4-0.
George, can you tell us more about this moment in your life in 2018?
Mm-hmm. June 28th, I think, 2018. I was coming back from a show that I had put on around the release of the episode 3 of my podcast, the Grenfell episode. The previous month, I had just launched the podcast. I was on a very intense schedule. I set myself ambitious targets. I released the first episode on the day that I also performed a special poem for Harry and Meghan Markle's wedding. So I was kind of on a roll. Life wasn't easy. I was working very hard, but the results were coming. And I had, after the show, driven to my parents' place. Before I walked into the house, I parked up outside and I was just catching up with my messages. I had a lot of tweets and DMs after the show, right? A van full of police pulled up. A handful of police walked out and asked me if I owned the car and told me to get out of the car. I said, no. And it escalated into a search for weapons. They said they had to search me for weapons because I was suspicious. My parents came out. They were very rude to my parents. My neighbors were awoken. They were rude to my neighbors. The ordeal went on for like, I don't know, maybe 40 minutes. And they eventually just drove off after searching me, a pretty invasive search. They just drove off without much of an apology or explanation.
And so when you tell that story in your podcast, what do you want people to hear? What are you trying to describe to them about the reality of life, of your life in Britain?
So interestingly, my podcast was intended to be an audio magazine of current affairs. That's what I wanted to focus on, specifically to support young sociology students. I wanted to incentivize people to study sociology. And I thought if I can make current affairs sound as interesting as it is in my head, then maybe I can win people over to sociology. I began episodes 1 and 2 with a broadly sociological focus. I started off by talking about criminal justice reform. Then I talked about educational reform and musical opportunity. Then I talked about, on episode 3, a particular tragedy, which would allow us to talk about a number of sociological prospects. But then the police interrupted me. So that's what I had to express in episode 4. They just interrupted me. They've just derailed my whole thought process. They've drained my productive energy. They've rattled me, and there is no recourse. There's no redress of grievances in this age-old game. And I was furious because I had drifted into a space in my life where I believed that I was able to reform my long-held biases against police. But that set me back about 10 years. That incident set me back mentally about 10 years.
I'm just trying to, I'm looking at the clock here because there's so, every one of the stories that you tell, George, it's worthy of multiple hours of continued exploration with you. Mm. And so I feel a little nervous about moving away from certain things that you say. But I do want to talk about, if I could, you talked about episode 3 of the podcast, and it's about Grenfell Tower. Now, I think it is important for us to spend some time on this because you're right. I mean, this was a disaster. We're just a couple of days off of the 3rd anniversary of this terrible tragedy in London, where a tower block, a 24-story tower block, went up in flames. It burned like it was an inferno, and more than 70 people died. And it was found out later that all sorts of things failed at that moment. The community was failed by the construction of the building, the policies put into place that kept people in a burning building. The simple fact that there weren't things like a water riser going up the building so that firefighters could have access to water as they were trying to stop the flame. And those are just a few of the failures here that caused the deaths of more than 70 people. And it, of course, like, damaged the lives of still hundreds more. So I just want to play a little excerpt of the podcast of when you muse on the name of Grenfell Tower, because it's named after Lord Francis Grenfell. And here's that moment.
Frankie fought in the south, east, and north, carrying that white man's burden, proceeding forth. See, even though he came from wealth on the battlefield, he made a name for himself, and because of his achievements and the time he spent alive, he was remembered when he died in 1925. He had a building named after him half a century on, and that name will last potentially long after we've eventually gone. You see, Lord Francis Grenfell is the first name on Grenfell Tower's Wikipedia page. But Grenfell Tower isn't even mentioned on his Wikipedia page.
George, can you tell me, I mean, you said this was the tragedy there was, it laid bare a lot of sociological issues in modern day Britain. So tell me more. What does Grenfell mean to you?
Grenfell signifies the over-dependency that many of us, the over-expectation that many of us have of British society. We expect that we can assimilate and make our own way with, if not the support of the state, then with minimal interference from the state. That's the dream that we're sold in migrating to this country. That's, you know, the difference that many of us value about some of the societies that we come from. We expect real self-determination in this place, but Grenfell Tower is a harsh reality that we need to be on guard, and we need to be proactive in our quest for social mobility, because we cannot assume that this country does not have tendencies that are potentially lethal to those of us who come from immigrant communities and rely on social housing.
Lethal how?
Oversight. The oversight of our agency, at the hands of state actors, councils, local governors, local government, architects, industry. It is possible for our experience to be completely overridden in the normal running of things. It's possible. It happens on a more gradual, less extreme level through pricing out of communities, you know, gentrification. It is expressed in many of the outcomes that we experience in healthcare, the fact that our black women are 5 times more likely to die in childbirth. That's a crisis. But you might not be aware of that as a black person for your whole life, because you're not in a society that regards it as a crisis. So if your home, if your livelihood, if your community is being systematically dismantled through, like I said, state actors in the private sector and industry, if that is happening, that is not necessarily a case of urgency. With regards to the establishment, with regards to the authority, and that oversight can have lethal consequences.
Well, I want to play one more moment from Have You Heard George's podcast. This is the final episode of Chapter 2, and you have an imagined phone call to the country of Uganda. Here it is.
It's been 20 years since we met. Where's all the time gone?
Can you imagine?
I thought you were the most gorgeous thing I'd ever laid eyes on. I was young, but I knew this obsession would be lifelong.
You are so young, Bambi. How's Britain?
She's alright. Getting cold. I'm sure you've seen there's an election coming.
Are you running? Or are you still running from your destiny?
Yo, if I became a politician now, my mouth would definitely get the best of me.
Yeah.
That's a moment from Have You Heard George's Podcast, Chapter 2. So this conversation, George, that you have with Uganda, what does that conversation reveal to you?
That I'm conflicted. I don't know where my ultimate allegiance lies, ultimately. I know nothing better. I know nothing in more detail than I know Black Britain, right? But Uganda is my spiritual home, and I feel it when I'm there because my thoughts clarify. The idea of the podcast occurred to me in Uganda. Some of the most life-changing decisions I've made have come about from the clarity I receive when I reconnect with the land of my ancestors. And I felt that from when I was 8 years old. However, at the same time, I know British society, I know Black Britain, and I do love Britain. And I kind of feel like I owe Britain my honesty and as much of my service as I can offer.
You know, can I just jump in here, George? Because I wish, I would like us to get to a place where it didn't feel like a conflict, right? Like what, that you wouldn't even have to ask yourself, where do your allegiances lie? That both could be simultaneously true. And it feels like both are simultaneously true, and yet you still feel this conflict.
Yeah, but for me, it feels like both are simultaneously true because I'm, like I was saying, proactively trying to map out this strategy. But if I went along with the ebb and flow of this British society and the UK and the economy, I would not be sufficiently engaged with Ugandan society, and I would not have solutions that I think could benefit Ugandan society as much as they could benefit British society.
Yeah. Point taken. Now, in that little clip that we played, there's a question. Uganda asks you, are you running? I mean, is politics in your future?
Oh, yeah. So it's a double entendre because...
Running away is the next line, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I am in politics. That's the reality.
Yeah.
That was my intention when I was in university and I decided not to become an MP or not to engage in party politics like I originally planned. Like I said, I graduated with the responsibility of sharing what I thought I had learned, and party politics wouldn't necessarily have empowered me to do that. So in sharing what I'm learning, I am able to influence people's political experience.
Well, George Mpenga, a.k.a. George the Poet, his podcast is called Have You Heard George's Podcast? It was the first ever European podcast to win a Peabody Award. It has won multiple other awards in the United Kingdom. It is truly a remarkable work. George, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Magna. I appreciate you.
And by the way, the music you've been hearing from the podcast is from... George's producer and collaborator, composer Ben Brick. So I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. What you know, believe that you can fly. They don't have to see what you see. Believe that you can fly. They don't have to feel what you feel. Believe that you can fly. They don't have to know what you know. Believe that you can fly.